One other thing about the text in the workbook is that if you look at the homework assignments or the syllabus, you'll see that I hope to get through only about half of the textbook this week. And I'll tell you why. The textbook and the workbook together are a full semester course. And by doing it in 1 week, we're covering about a week's worth of material in 1 day. And in 6 days, you're going to cover about half a semester's worth of work. But I hope by the end of the week, you will have learned enough about logic, about the fundamentals of logic, that you can continue on in the book, in the workbook, on your own, and finish what we have started here in the first 6 days. I'd be happy if we covered more than that, but I think it's unrealistic to expect to do so. Logic requires a lot of thought. It requires some hard thinking. In fact, to do it right, you need to do a lot more problem solving, as it were, than we're going to be able to do in 6 days. It's sort of like learning geometry or mathematics in the sense that it's cumulative. What we talked about yesterday is the basis for what we'll be talking about today. Today will be the basis for what we talk about tomorrow. And you have to remember all of that as we go through it. And that's very difficult to do in a short space of time. Another announcement, briefly, is that the books in the lobby, if you haven't seen them, please stop by. The books are available at half price. Any of the books on philosophy or theology out there. So please stop by and take a look at some of those. There is, as Clark emphasizes later in the textbook on logic, a great deal of philosophy surrounding the study of logic. And if you become more and more familiar with philosophy, your understanding of logic will improve as well. Let's begin today by going through the homework assignment, the first 6 pages of the workbook, 1 through 6. And you'll see how the workbook is set up. It begins each chapter with an outline of the chapter in the textbook. And then the author has put in important terms to be defined. And we discussed about most of these yesterday. Can anybody tell me what ambiguity is, either from the lectures or from your reading? What is ambiguity? Yes, sir. Okay. Having more than one meaning. It's ambiguous. How about argument? What's an argument? Anybody recall what an argument is? Yes, sir. Okay, a series of statements or reasons used to support or prove a conclusion, a theory, or an inference. What's a conclusion? What is a conclusion? You recall we had the syllogisms up on the overhead yesterday? Which part of those was the premise and which was the conclusion? Okay. It's something that is deduced. It's distinguished from a premise. A premise is the argument or the reason, the statements that you begin with. The conclusion is what is deduced from those premises. What's an enthymeme? Yes, sir.
It's an argument in which one or more of the inferences is understood or left out.
One or more of the premises. One or more of the premises is understood or left out. That's an enthymeme. How about logic? How did we define logic? It was a very short definition. Okay, the science of necessary inference. That's the next phrase. What's necessary inference? Well, it's good response because we really didn't discuss it yesterday. And we're going to be talking about it not even today. We're going to be talking about it probably tomorrow, what necessary inference is. Well, what's the premise? Yes. Very good. A proposition upon which an argument is based or from which a conclusion is drawn. Notice the indicator words. As a good exercise here, you have the premise indicators and the conclusion indicators. Read the book of Romans sometime. And just notice how many times Paul uses such words as then and therefore or because or for that reason. And it's not just the book of Romans. That's just an example I'm using. But read it. Read a section of the Bible and notice the indicator words, even for premises or for conclusions. And I think you'll be astounded at the number of times those words appear and arguments are being presented that you may have overlooked before. Now, this isn't a complete list, obviously. There are other words that might indicate such things, but this is a helpful list of such words to help you recognize premises and conclusions in arguments. Let's look at exercise 1.1 on page 3. Who would like to read and give the correct answer for number 1? An argument is a series of blank used to prove the truth of what one wishes to assert. It's a series of what? Yes, sir.
Reasons
H. Blank is the study of the methods by which the conclusion is proved beyond all doubt. What's that? Logic. And what's the letter?
Yeah.
F. Logic is the science of blank inference, necessary inference. Letter G. If a knowledge of God is important, we are under great obligation to argue blank.
K,
validly. An argument in which a part is omitted or taken for granted is called what? Enthymeme. Very good. An enthymeme. Letter B. Words such as for, because, since, hence, and therefore are examples of blank words in arguments. D, indicator words. In a valid argument, the relation between premises and conclusion is such that it is impossible for the premises to be blank and the conclusion blank. Okay. And we're going to see a little bit later on a slight amendment to that to make it strictly the case. Arguments can be valid even though one or all of their premises or conclusion may be blank. What's the word there? False. Remember, the statements, the propositions are true or false. The argument is valid or invalid. Words or terms having different meanings are said to be blank if the context does not indicate which meaning is intended. A, ambiguous. The slogan, save soap and waste paper, is an example of blank language. Ambiguous language. Okay. What war did that slogan appear in? Does anybody know? World War I. Okay, let's look at the next exercise on page 5. Yes, sir. Ambiguous is ambiguous. It has more than one meaning. One is equivocation and one is amphibology. And that's how you would distinguish that idea. Either a phrase or a single word can be ambiguous. If a single word is ambiguous, it's equivocation. If a phrase is ambiguous, it's amphibology. Okay, let's look at number one here. What the author's done is given you three statements, lettered each one, A, B, and C, and asked you to identify which are the premises and which are the conclusions. What is the order of the letters for number one? A, B, C. How about B, A, C? Does anybody have B, A, C? Of course, it's fine too. Either one. And do you see why it's fine? Okay. How about number two? ACB or CAB? Number three, what's the order there? Over here? Somebody said it. ABC. Number three. How about number four? ACB. Number five, ACB or CAB. Number six, CBA. CBA, number six. Number seven, ACB, number seven or CAB. Number eight, I'm sorry, BCA or CBA, either one. And number nine, BCA. Number nine is BCA or CBA. Number 10 in the back. Oh, okay, go ahead. Yes, it should be marked. It should be marked with an A, the first sentence. Good point. I need to make a note of that. Okay, number 10. I'm sorry? No. No. ABC. That's ACB. That seems to be the only one that we had difficulty with. ABC or BAC. Okay, well, that was very good. Now, if you have any difficulty with any of these, you know, let me know, because I don't want to rush through this and lose the whole class. With number 10? Well, since men suppress the truth, so that has to be a premise. That's the reason for what follows. It follows that men do not want to know the truth. That's the second premise. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that, and then the conclusion is they know guilt instead. What you have here, and we haven't gotten to this point yet, is really two immediate inferences in which the conclusion of from the first inference acts as a premise for the second immediate inference.
Is this a valid argument?
Well, there are premises missing. It's an enthymeme, but it is valid. Now, that's all. I do not want you to go ahead and do pages 7 through 9 at this point, because Filling in those enthymemes is too difficult at this point in the study. Perhaps later in the week we can return to those pages, but if you attempt it at this point, it's going to be quite difficult. Let's turn our attention instead to a study of informal fallacies over the remainder of this class and the next class. Informal logical fallacies. Informal logical fallacies. Now, there are two kinds of fallacies. First, what's a fallacy? Anybody recall from your reading? An invalid argument. It's a mistake in reasoning. It's a mistake in reasoning. There are two kinds of mistakes, formal and informal. This doesn't mean that it doesn't have anything to do with a tire. It means that one kind of mistake concerns the form of the argument, and we'll explain that phrase a little bit later. Another kind of mistake, which we're talking about in this class period, has to do with the usage of the English language, either grammar or syntax or the meaning of words. It's an informal fallacy. It's not a formal fallacy in the argument at all. If you turn to page 12 in your workbook, the author has listed there on one page several informal fallacies, and I hope to give you several more besides those. And let me put some of these up on the overhead. Yes. Any mistake that isn't due to a mistake in the form of the argument is an informal fallacy. The first one that we're going to mention is the abusive ad hominem. I mentioned this in passing yesterday. Ad hominem is a Latin phrase meaning to the man. You see this AD in several of the names of these fallacies. And this means that you're abusing his character or you're raising irrelevant issues about his character. An abusive ad hominem is a logical fallacy in which irrelevancies of character are used as reasons for rejecting a position. Proposition X cannot be true because Mr. Jones, who believes X, is a drunkard. Or you can fill in the blank there. Mr. Jones is a Republican. You hear this in politics all the time. Or Mr. Jones is a Democrat. Or Mr. Jones is a communist. Therefore, you cannot believe what he says to be true. This is raising an irrelevant matter. I mentioned yesterday about Balaam's donkey and how even the donkey can speak the truth. And sometimes drunkards speak the truth. Now, less frequently, it doesn't take the form of an abuse, but as a praise of someone's character. That is, proposition X must be true because Mr. Jones is a nice man. You hear that less frequently. Usually it comes in the form of abuse. And that's why it's called abusive ad hominem. But sometimes it takes the praise form as well. That somehow a proposition is supported by the character of the person making that statement. Yes, sir?
So then the position that logic is not necessary because, or is not Christian because Aristotle was a pagan, is an abusive ad hominem.
That's right. That's an example of an argument that some Christians use, is that because the laws of thought, the three laws of thought we talked about yesterday, were first, to our knowledge, formulated by Aristotle, that somehow we can't trust them. because Aristotle was a pagan. Or that somehow Euclidean geometry is worthless because he sacrificed to his idols on discovering the Pythagorean theorem, or Pythagorean, getting Euclid and Pythagoras mixed up, but because that's useless because of that. Well, that has nothing to do with the Pythagorean theorem or Euclidean geometry or the laws of thought, the character of the men involved. If you're going to deal with an argument, if you're going to deal with a statement, then you have to restrict yourself to things that are relevant to the case. In everyday life, we are very lax in what we do and say, and frequently we find ourselves using this abusive ad hominem or praise ad hominem. If you watch the Simpson trial on television, you'll see that the standards are a little bit stricter as to what the lawyers can say and the questions they can ask, and the judge sometimes sustains objections if he feels the question is irrelevant to the matter at hand. And certainly a judge would throw out any argument based on the abusive ad hominem. Well, the second one is accent, an informal logical fallacy in which the meaning of a sentence, phrase, or word is misunderstood because it is dependent on the inflection of the voice. And Clark gives an example of this from the Bible. Usually at the Lord's Supper, the minister or an elder, speaking of the wine, will say, "Drink ye all of this." Now that can mean all of you drink this, or drink all of it. Drink ye all of this. And the meaning of that phrase depends on the inflection of the person's voice. Drink ye all of this means all of you drink it. Drink ye all of this means don't have any left over. Let's consume all the wine. So there is an example of a fallacy, an informal fallacy, of accent, because it depends on the inflection of the voice. This might occur in a written document if the person hasn't heard the speaker say the words. The speaker might be speaking ironically. He might be saying something sarcastically. But when his words are put on paper, and the inflection isn't there anymore, then he may be understood as speaking literally. And this can lead to all sorts of misunderstandings and problems for the readers. So that's one thing to keep in mind about the fallacy of accent. The third one here is accident. Let me see if I have a overhead for that. An informal logical fallacy in which an irrelevant accidental factor becomes the essential point in an argument. And if you've read the text, you know the story that Dr. Clark tells about the cook who was commanded by his master to prepare a stork for the guests who were coming to dinner. So the cook prepares the stork, and it smells so delicious he can't keep from eating one of its legs. So he eats the stork's leg and then serves the stork to the guest and the master, lying on its side so as to try to hide the fact that the stork has one leg. And the master recognizes it and becomes infuriated with the cook, but he's very polite at the time. But he swears that he'll get the cook in the morning. And in the morning he takes the cook out to the front yard of the castle, and points at a stork and says, "Look, storks have two legs. What did you do with the leg of the stork last night?" And the stork happened to be standing on one leg at the time, and the cook says, "Look, they have only one leg." So the master goes, and the stork, startled, flies away and puts down its other leg to get off the ground. And the master says, "See, they have two legs." And the cook says, "But you didn't clap last night." That's the fallacy of accident. A reason that's completely accidental to the whole question. Here's another Latin phrase. And if you ever have a chance to use Latin, use it. Everybody will think you're very learned. Ad baculum, to the stick. An informal logical fallacy in which an appeal to force and threats is made. This is how a bank robber persuades the teller to turn over the money. It's not the force of his logical reasons, but the appeal to the stick or to the gun in which he makes his argument. Turn over the money or I'll shoot you dead. Here's the Latin phrase again, ad hominem, meaning to the man. This is very important, and it's to be distinguished from the abusive ad hominem. Tonight, when I talk about Christ's use of logic, we'll see how he uses ad hominem arguments repeatedly in his confrontations with the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the lawyers. It's a form of argument that accepts the propositions accepted by another for the purpose of deducing contradictory propositions or propositions that would be rejected by the other person. Ad hominem should be distinguished from abusive ad hominem. Now, why do we classify it as a fallacy? Strictly speaking, it's not. Strictly speaking, it is a sound argument, a valid argument. But because the starting point of the argument is the propositions believed by another person, propositions which are false in most cases, it ends up being a mistake in reasoning. We're going to run into the same problem with a fallacy called begging the question in a few minutes. It's not really a fallacy at all. Strictly speaking, it's a valid argument. But as far as persuading someone of the truth of your conclusion, it's probably useless. The next one up there should be the appeal to pity. Another Latin phrase here. Ad misericordiam, Latin meaning to pity. Well, you can see the word misery in there. An informal logical fallacy which appeals to the pity of the hearer. And you've all heard the story, I'm sure, of the Menendez brothers who shot their parents and then appealed to the pity of the court because they were orphans. That is an appeal to pity. You hear it in politics all the time, in political questions, that we have to support a certain program, or we have to accept this view of things or that view of things because of the pitiable nature of the people involved. Those are not good reasons, irrelevant reasons, for accepting a conclusion. Another Latin phrase, and the numbers up there, in case you're wondering and haven't read your glossary, refer to the page numbers in the text where you can find out more information about these informal fallacies. This is an appeal to the people. It's an informal logical fallacy involving an appeal to popular opinion. Why can't I go see movie X? Everybody is doing it. There's an appeal to the people, an appeal to popular opinion. You see it in advertisements. Drink Coke. It's the most popular soft drink in America. You should get on the bandwagon. You should accept whatever proposition the politician or the advertiser wants you to accept, or do whatever they want you to do because of the appeal of popular opinion. One doesn't discover truth, as someone said, by counting noses. And that's what this particular informal fallacy appeals to. Somehow truth is made by majority vote. Well, that's not the case. Okay, ambiguity, a word, it should be, or a phrase in there, susceptible of more than one meaning. Now, in the list on page 12, the next word is amphibology. Let me find that one for you. Amphibology. A phrase or sentence susceptible of more than one meaning, also spelled amphiboly. And the example or Clark gives at one point is, I don't recall now what his example is, but I'll give you one that,
Ben Franklin,
okay. We must all hang together or we will all hang separately. Or the sign that was in the laundromat, when the buzzer sounds, customers must remove their clothes. It has more than one meaning. Obviously, the person who hung it there had one meaning in mind, and perhaps hadn't thought of the other one. That's an instance of amphibology. Complex question. Let me see if I have an overhead for that one. Complex question there. Another informal fallacy, consisting of two or more questions or a question with two or more assumptions in it. Judges, good judges, are particularly hard on this. They will insist that lawyers frame their questions to witnesses so that they are not in any fashion complex questions. And the proverbial example of the complex question is, have you stopped beating your wife yet? And if you answer yes, it seems to imply that you beat her in the past, but you've stopped doing it. And if you answer no, it seems to imply that you're continuing to beat your wife. Now, that's a complex question. The next in the book here is equivocation. Equivocation is a type of ambiguity. Give me a second here and I'll find the right sheet. There's equivocation, a word susceptible of more than one meaning. That's distinguished from an amphibology, which is a phrase or a sentence susceptible of more than one meaning. Save soap and waste paper. Well, it depends on whether waste is an adjective or a verb. There's an example of an equivocal word there. Save soap and waste paper. Actually, you should say it the way it was intended, save soap and waste paper. Say it a little faster. Clark makes the point in the book that these are not systematic, the informal fallacies, that sometimes you'll run across instances where they can be classified in two or more ways, rather than simply as a one particular way. Let me see. Composition, the fallacy of composition. The characteristic of the part is attributed to the whole. This is very common in our thinking as well. We somehow think if a part has a peculiar characteristic, then the whole has to have the same characteristic. I think one of the examples that Dr. Clark gives is of the German philosopher Leibniz, his theory of monads, individual thinking minds, which do not occupy space. People objected to the theory on the basis that, well, how can you combine monads and come up with bodies which occupy space? And it's an example of the fallacy of composition. He gives the example of table salt. There you have sodium chloride being made up of sodium and chlorine, both of which are poisons. But combined, they improve the flavor of some food. They are not poisonous. They do not have the same characteristic. The whole does not have the same characteristic as each part. One might argue, to take another example, that because a grain of sand weighs almost nothing, that a truckload of sand weighs almost nothing. The qualities of the whole are quite different. Now, there is another fallacy closely related. In fact, it's the other side of the coin here, the fallacy of division. This is the fallacy that the characteristics of the whole must belong to each part. The characteristics of the whole must belong to each part. This is equally fallacious. It's not necessarily true that if a truckload of sand weighs a ton, that each piece of sand, each particle, each grain of sand is also heavy. It's not necessarily true that if table salt is good for some food, that the components of table salt would be good for some food. Yes? Fallacy of division. It's the relationship between the whole and the part. And you see it many times, particularly if you study some of the human or social or political sciences, people get confused on that as well. Now, we've covered formal fallacy, which is the mistake in the form of the argument, and informal fallacy, which is a mistake not in the form of the argument, but in English usage. Now we have another Latin phrase here. See if I can come up with the overhead for it. The next two, in fact. Petitio principii, begging the question. I mentioned this earlier. And you can see the root for our English word petition there. It's actually a valid form of argument, although many people regard it as an informal fallacy, in which one of the premises from which the conclusion is deduced is the conclusion itself in disguised form. It's regarded as an informal logical fallacy because it is unconvincing to someone who does not accept the premise conclusion. There's a very famous example of this in philosophy. It's Thomas Aquinas' first argument for the existence of God. And I'll talk about that, I think it's Thursday night, when I talk about empirical apologetics. But it's a very famous example from one of the greatest Aristotelian thinkers in history, begging the question. Why is it valid, strictly speaking? Well, it's valid, strictly speaking, because every statement implies itself. It has to. Thomas wanted to prove the existence of a first cause, or a first mover, as he put it. He was following Aristotle. And in the course of the argument, he says there has to be a first mover. And then at the conclusion of the argument, he says, and this is the first mover. Well, he smuggled his conclusion back up into his premises and committed this fallacy of begging the question. And one more Latin phrase, post hoc ergo propter hoc. After this, therefore, because of this, another fallacy. I read a book a few years ago by a Presbyterian elder who had converted to Roman Catholicism, and he explains in the book why he did so and why he began worshiping Mary. And the way he explains it is he performed an experiment. He had a problem that he couldn't solve. He thought it was an insoluble problem. So he said some Hail Marys just as an experiment to see what would happen. And within 3 months, this insoluble problem was solved. And he attributed the solution of the problem to Mary and to his prayer to Mary. And that's as good as an example as I can give of post hoc ergo propter hoc. It's a fallacy of after this, therefore because of this. It's seeing a causal connection when all that's there is a chronological sequence. Something happens and something else happens right after it. And you're concluding that for some reason the first thing caused the second one. Almost all superstitions begin that way. People will recall that something, Aunt Matilda fell down and broke her leg after she saw a black cat cross in front of her car, or something of that sort. And that is an example of post hoc ergo propter hoc. Look out for black cats, or don't walk under ladders, or stay off the cracks in the sidewalk, you name it. And it happens on a more sophisticated level in the field of science as well. Post hoc, ergo propter hoc. Yes, sir?
Is